From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading creators, writers, and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll bring you conversations with two comedy titans. Veep showrunner and Seinfeld writer David Mandel will discuss the wildly successful HBO series that wrapped in 2019.
Our entire show is always based on Selena makes a mistake and then pays the price for that mistake. That's every episode of Veep. It was a great formula, but it stopped feeling like reality.
And legendary screenwriter Daniel Petrie Jr. will examine the 1985 comedy classic Beverly Hills Cop.
Having it be a guy from Detroit investigating a crime in Beverly Hills, I thought doing a fish out of water comedy would be the best approach.
On Story from Austin Film Festival. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's script and film competitions are currently accepting submissions. All script entrants receive free readers' comments, and advancing writers will be afforded exclusive panels, workshops, and networking opportunities at Austin Film Festival's annual Writers' Conference each October. For more information on badges, passes, or to submit, visit www.austinfilmfestival.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. For seven seasons, Veep hilariously followed the personal life and political career of Selena Meyer, played by Julia Louise Dreyfus. The award-winning series' final 3 years were helmed by showrunner and executive producer David Mandel. Mandel has a long history of comedic writing, having also worked on Saturday Night Live, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and classic Seinfeld episodes like The Bizarro Jerry and The Betrayal. I spoke with Mandel about bringing the critically acclaimed HBO series to a close at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Veep, courtesy of Home Box Office Inc.
So can you talk a little bit about how you started in comedy and, you know, what was it that drove you to it?
You know, I was not the class clown or anything like that. I was very overly studious, head of student government kind of thing. But I could make my friends laugh, like my friends knew. But I was straight A student guy and went to Harvard. And the part that nobody likes, I joined the Harvard Lampoon. And after that, I worked at Comedy Central. I did Indecision 92, which was Al Franken's comedy coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions. And then at the end of that, he brought me over to Saturday Night Live, and then from there went to Seinfeld. So that was sort of my path.
Well, so then you inherit this already beloved show, and a process that, I mean, I've read a lot about Iannucci's process on this show, but you have your own way of doing things, and you've got to come into an established fan base and product and new cast. What I'd really love to hear about is when that opportunity first arose, how you started to work through it in your head about how you're going to approach this, and then what you actually did when you entered the show.
You know, when I got the phone call, it was sort of very out of the blue. And I was hesitant. I mean, I don't know what else to say. Not scared, not nervous, just hesitant. Because, well, why wouldn't you be? I was a huge fan of the show. It obviously very much had a voice. It just sort of was like, huh, okay. So, you know, you don't jump at these things. And I'll be very honest. You know, Julie and I had known each other on Seinfeld. We sat down and had a very sort of casual and very nice conversation. And look, I guess I would have probably taken the job just to work with Julia again. I mean, she's just an incredible combo of both, you know, the acting part, but also the comedy chops. But the real truth is, it was when I got the scripts and some of the rough cuts for what was season four. And season four is the season that ends with the Electoral College tie.
Okay, it all comes down to Virginia. If O'Brien gets Virginia, he wins. However, if we get Virginia...
We win!
No, actually, Gary, if we get it, we tie.
What?
What? I don't follow these things that closely, but that's right, isn't it, Mr. Davidson?
Yes.
Tie? Like it's a tie? You mean we tie?
You do.
And it was really, I guess, really my writer's ego that I was so fascinated. I love the ending. I love the notion of the tie. It seemed like such an impossible corner to leave the show in, to walk away and kind of just go, it's a tie, goodbye. It just, I mean, it was one of those things where I just couldn't stop thinking about the tie and how to resolve it and what would be the funniest way to resolve it. And as I started thinking, the pieces just started kind of coming out of me. And, you know, I would have these conversations with Julie, and each time it was like I'd bring a little more. So first it was sort of really just thinking about, well, should she win or should she lose? And what she wants in the world most is the presidency. She has to lose. So, okay, she's going to lose. And then start thinking about, well, who should she lose to? What if she loses to another woman? What if she loses to maybe even a younger woman with a good husband and really nice kids? Sort of the world of everything she doesn't have. And so these pieces start coming together. And then at that point, it was sort of like I had no choice but to take the job. You know what I mean? And, you know, just start going, well, who's the woman? Well, wait a second. The other side has to have a vice presidential nominee. Montez. They've said the name. We've never seen her. We can cast, you know, it just, the ball starts rolling. And my sort of feeling in general, people always ask, like, how do you know when it's a good idea? Or how do you know if something's funny? Well, I think I'm a laugher. If I laugh, I think it's funny. And how do I think something's a good idea? If when you hear that idea, you start like going down different paths just off of that idea, I think it's a good idea. There are good ideas where sometimes you sit there and go, oh God, what do I do with that? Don't get me wrong, but it just started flowing. It kind of just started, you know, pouring out. And that was really like, I have to do this. And that's kind of how it happened. You know, talking about previous experiences, I was taught to write sitcoms by Larry David at Seinfeld. And it's outline, 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 structure, structure, structure. And so I go into a season at the very beginning, not only knowing what I want to do, but I know what the first scene is, and I know what the last scene is going to be of the season. And because I know what the last scene of the season is going to be, I'm also even thinking about what the first scene of the following season is going to be. And I map out all 10 episodes of the seasons. And we're in a room where there's, you know, I don't know, 7 whiteboards divided into 10 columns, and I am taking you through all 10 episodes. And I can't say to you, nothing changes, but 90% of what you see on the screen is on those whiteboards at the beginning of the season. And during those early times, we just start bringing in guests. So every day there's like a lunch guest or something, kind of like a salon. So we're bringing in reporters, people that worked on the Obama campaign, people that worked on previous campaigns, you know, just different interesting people. And we're getting stuff from them constantly. So, for example, Tommy Vitor, one of the Pod Saves America guys, who was one of the guys in charge of Obama in Iowa, told us a story when he came in about Obama, them landing at the wrong airport. And the second we heard that, that actually became the first scene of, that replaced, and that was like, oh, that's the new first scene of the season.
Hello, Iowa, I'm...
Selina Meyer.
Wait a minute, where is everyone?
Maybe they're hiding.
Where? Amy, where are you?
At the airport, where are you?
I mean, there's only one runway.
I'm at the airport. We just landed.
That's not possible.
Right now, I'm standing here
with my in my hand in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Ma'am, we're in Cedar Rapids.
No!
This is supposed to be now, Selina!
Now!
I mean, you did stay true to the sort of pillars of the comedy of the show, which were the incompetence and the narcissism and the malaise, I guess, for the American people. But you added some stuff. I mean, Richard Splett is one of my favorite characters now in all of television, and he seemed to just come out of
nowhere.
And then became... So can you talk about that?
Yeah,
what your thought in bringing him in was?
Sure, I'll say two things. I think by definition, there are also certain things that as me, that I had that, you know, the Armando and the Brits didn't have. I had a much more of a working knowledge of American politics and American history. So when you watch my episodes, you will hear references to things like the Spanish-American War that they just wouldn't have done because they're not taught about the Spanish-American War. We, you know, I think we reference more candidates. I think we reference people out of history more. One of my absolute favorite jokes, I did not write it. I think Ted Cohn wrote it, but I can't swear, was we did a joke about Clyde Tolleson's hysterical pregnancy.
Isn't it astounding that the next president of the United States is being chosen by a closeted ex-record producer?
The Electoral College hasn't exactly been hitting it out of the park.
And, I mean, is it just me, or does Felix's friend seem a little young?
He'll look older after Felix switches blood with him.
Ma'am, Felix Wade's sexuality is the worst best-kept secret since Clyde Tolson's hysterical pregnancy.
The man lives in a vast, invisible closet.
Sounds amazing.
I'm gonna be sick.
Now, I don't expect anyone in this room to necessarily all know who Clyde Tolleson is. He was J. Edgar Hoover's lover and a man who could not actually get pregnant, thus the hysterical pregnancy. And I will make the argument that is not a joke the Brits ever would have written. I love it to death. You have to know a lot about the history of the FBI. That's just an example. Another thing, and I swear I'm coming back to Richard in a second, I noticed race was not a big thing that they had ever sort of dove into. And I thought certainly, you know, just with Obama as the president and whatnot, you had to. And so right in our first episode, there's the all-white committee on race kind of a thing right there in the first episode.
Madam President, Lisa Burke, co-chair of African American Studies at Howard.
Oh, Miss Burke, is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, every difficult conversation starts with a sentence. What the f*** is going on here? Why are they all white?
Looks like the NHL All-Star Weekend.
Okay. Hello.
Franklin Washington, Morehouse University.
Now, Morehouse University is historically an African-American university.
Historic.
Okay.
And obviously that was based on some of those Republican things where, like, they'll do a woman's health thing and it's all men. So that was the inspiration thereof. Because it was season five, there was an opportunity in ways you couldn't have in season one to kind of dig into who these people were. So that, like, you've had 4 years of Selena doing all of this horrific narcissism and whatnot. Well, we've referenced her mother once or twice. Let's find out more about what makes her tick. And that was definitely something they did not do. They sort of almost stayed away from quote-unquote home life. And we didn't do a lot of it, but I thought it was a chance to really dig into who these characters were and sort of expand the palette of the show. And so I'll end on this one other point, which gets me back to your actual question, which is, I was a fan of the show. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching the show, and there were definitely things that I remembered and wondered about. So, for example, like the reference to Labor Day, if you're a fan of the show, it was this mysterious moment between Gary and Selena where something happened on Labor Day.
I have broken my body for you.
Oh, come on.
I have let myself be laughed at. I have let myself be humiliated, and I'm happy to do it.
Okay.
Most of the time, you don't even know that I exist, but I am everything to you.
Oh, I am so happy to get somebody else to give me my hand cream.
Okay, go.
Yeah.
Can you find somebody else who did what I did?
You mean on Labor Day?
I didn't say that.
Yeah, you did. You just did. You just said Labor Day.
I said I would never mention that, ever.
As a fan, I always wondered what Labor Day was. And so for me, it was like, well, I don't know if we're going to say what it is, but we're going to try and put in a couple of other pieces of information about Labor Day that make it more interesting. So you thought it was a day, and we later revealed it was a boat. And Mike McClintock, at one point, if you guys remember, had sperm in the refrigerator. They were trying to get pregnant. That was something I was really curious about, and that's what led to the whole Chinese adoption storyline in my first season. Again, that came out of being a fan of the show and seeing these sort of, like, whether they were threads or things I remembered or things I liked.
On Story from Austin Film Festival, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Veep showrunner David Mandel. The series followed the turbulent rise of politician Selina Meyer. Veep took home 2 Emmy Awards for Outstanding Comedy Series over the 3 years that Mandel led the show.
And so with Richard, I mean, Sam was just so good. And this idea of what if he's an election expert, and now because of this tie, you know, all of a sudden he's sort of thrust ahead of Jonah, and they're related. And so that's as simple as where it started. And then once it was kind of going, it was like, oh God, what if she trusts Richard also more than Amy? And that starts to drive Amy crazy. And in some ways that basically led to, what if we come back a year later and Richard's her chief of staff? And at some point it became, what if one day Richard actually is president of the United States?
The presidential motorcade has arrived, and here comes President of the United States, Richard Splett, and the First Lady, Annette Splett. Somber but elegant, basking in the glow of a landslide re-election following President Splett's historic three-state solution Middle East peace agreement, for which he won the Nobel Prize.
And that's how those things grow. But it really came out of, I guess, being a fan of the show and then getting to go work on the show.
Richard did become a great catalyst to dredge up the really screwed up relationships all these people actually had and to sort of bring out some of their worst traits. You
know? He also, in a world of a lot of horrible characters who, I guess my biggest fear always is making sure that nobody sounds the same. That was always a worry for me writing Veep, is just that even when they're horrible and vindictive, that they sound different, that an Amy line has to sound different than a Dan line, and both of them have to sound different than a Selena line, well, you know, et cetera. Richard is a different energy. He's got a kindness to him. He's sort of he still, I think, believes in government. And so that energy and then that voice started to, we really did pick up on that sort of line he did, again, before I was there, which was,
Richard T. Splett. Don't know why I said T, my middle name's John.
Of him delivering information and then undercutting his own information. And my absolute favorite one, I have 2 favorites that Sam knows I love. One was at the very end of the season when Selena lost and she's sitting there with Richard in the White House in the middle of the night and she's drunk and whatever. And he's talking to her. She's talking about loss. And he goes, oh, my auntie was always like that and whatever. And then he goes, you know, actually, she was more like a sister to me or an older sister to me. I was raised by my grandmother. And he goes, wait a second. And he realizes his aunt was his mother and that the woman he thought was his mother was his grandmother. Which,
if I was a little girl and you said to me, what do you want to do? I would have said, please, can I be president? And then it turned out to be the 12 loneliest months of my life.
My auntie used to talk about loneliness like that.
Okay, so right, you know that.
Yeah. We were pretty close, especially because my mother was so much older. Old enough to be my grandmother, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Maybe my auntie was actually my real mother, and my mother was actually my grandmother. Ah, wow, that's starting to make a lot of sense. Everybody knew about it but me, too.
I mean, like, just, like, talk about just a monster home run. And then the other one, that one was me, and the one I take no credit for was Lou Morton, was in episode 1 of this last season. It's like, Richard, you live here? And he says, like, boasters or roasters, my grandma always said, or... And then he goes, she had a disease, and it was a form of, like, it was a rhyming disease, and it was called Lindrome Syndrome. And then he pauses, and I just giggle at that to this day. Anyway, and look, I will also say a credit, and I didn't cast him, but a credit to, it's like you have Sam there, and I can give him more already in this incredible cast. And then we kept adding more people, too. I mean, it was insane, but kind of great.
Well, and I know this is something you've probably answered a million times, but looking at topically each episode, what you're doing compared to what is happening in the moment in the world, and how much are you really trying to pay attention to that, and how much are you just throwing it all to the wind because God knows what's going to happen next, you know?
The rules sort of changed. We sort of did 2 seasons in one way and a final season in a very different way. Up till the final season, just to try and answer that quickly, we weren't paying particularly much attention to what was happening on a given day, other than sort of listening for, you know, funny, interesting things like, you know, as I said, an all-male women's reproductive health thing, which was a relatively, at the time, current thing that had happened that we sort of took from. But at the same time, not a huge story, not a front page story. You had to be, I'll say, looking for it. And we were. We were, you know, you start reading, you know, I went from, you know, reading one newspaper a day to, you know, sort of five or six newspapers and a bunch of political newsletters, you know, and we were always trying to really avoid, in some ways, what was going on right then. You know, we always, I don't think we ever mentioned a president after Reagan. That's kind of where the timeline split. So again, we took influence from everywhere, but, you know, we weren't worrying much about it. Our entire show is always based on Selena makes a mistake and then pays the price for that mistake. That's every episode of Veep, if you look at them kind of deep down. She tries to do something, she screws up, and then whatever it is she wanted, she doesn't get. It was a great formula, but it stopped feeling like reality. It seemed like you make a mistake and the country doesn't really remember it 5 minutes later and rewards you for it. And so basically, in that sort of nether time before we were back, I just sort of pulled the show apart and just started thinking, this is not reflecting now. And it was very hard because obviously you do worry about, we're not Saturday Night Live, we're not on every night, we're not on every Saturday. So we weren't going to make the show about what did he say that week. But you try and get above it as much as possible and go, what is this about? And so it, you know, this, the notion of an authoritarian regime, let's not worry about Trump or this guy or this guy, but why are there authoritarian regimes coming to sort of to power? Let's not do fake news, which is the thing Trump says, but let's try and address why are facts and science sort of getting warred upon? And that's how we kind of led our way to a lot of the Jonah stuff, especially his war on math and his, you know, And you know, and you can laugh, but I hope you can see the connections to what we were trying to do. And it was really hard because obviously throughout the season, people kept going, oh, you're, you know, she's Trump, he's Trump, he's Kellyanne, she's Kellyanne. Yes, but no. We were trying to adjust a show that very quickly seemed out of date. When you watch, go back and watch, I don't know, you know, in my first season, we did the president is tweeting joke.
The president is tweeting.
She's tweeting. I just have to go in. The president asked
me. I can't believe it, please. Sir, I'm sorry.
Please, Marjorie, please. I have to talk to the president.
Please take a step back.
Look, please. Oh, no.
Ma'am.
Yes.
It turns out our prisoner's name is Abdullah Fahid, a local school teacher.
What is he doing? What is that?
Beats me. Hi, ma'am. If you hear this, do not tweet. Please.
Mike, what are you doing?
You tweeted.
What?
About O'Brien. It wasn't nice.
I just direct messaged Charlie.
No, it was public. Everybody saw it on Twitter.
That seems like it was written in the 1800s now. You know, the whole show seems, I hate to say this, somewhat of another time. Almost the same thing with the West Wing. They seem like this. If I said to you, when is Veep about? You'd be like, oh, it's the 60s. You know what I mean? It just seems like a different show. And so we really did have to change the show in that final season. And it got nastier, and it got meaner, and it got bleaker, and it got more horrible. And part of that was, I felt it had to, because these are horrible, bleak times. But I will also point out, it was built not to sustain, meaning you don't do that for 10 more seasons. You do that knowing this is the final season and we are going to build to the bleakest of all endings, which is she is going to ultimately, where story meets character, you know, the most important things you can do in any writing, she is going to throw Gary, the only person in some ways that she ever actually cared for, she is going to put a bullet in his head, a la Fredo.
I gotta get out of politics.
Now, to be honest, I never thought you were really cut out for it anyway.
Finally, I wanted to say a word about sacrifice. It means to lose something for the greater good. And when I look back on my 52 years, with almost 30 of them spent in public service, there is no one who has sacrificed more than me.
And when you realize that that's where we're building to, she has to take this journey into a just a darker place so that she can do the one thing you never thought she would do. And she does it, and you hate her for it, and she pays a horrific price. But that, I guess, to me, ta-da, that's politics.
Next up, a conversation with comedy legend Daniel Petrie Jr. Petrie's first produced screenplay, Beverly Hills Cop, was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. It grossed over $300 million at the box office and spawned two sequels. Greg Garrett spoke with Petrie at the 26th Annual Austin Film Festival. Clips of Beverly Hills Cop, courtesy of Paramount Pictures Corporation.
In 1975, according to Hollywood lore, Paramount head Michael Eisner got pulled over by a Beverly Hills cop who looked at his battered station wagon and treated him with barely disguised contempt. The next day, Eisner traded his old beater in for a new Mercedes. And he went to Paramount and told execs there that they needed to do a movie about the Beverly Hills police force. So that was 1975. In 1985, Daniel Petrie Jr.'s script for Beverly Hills Cop competed for a Best Original Screenplay Oscar. Now, in the years between those dates, there are some amazing stories. And that is what we are gathered here today to hear from Dan himself. Beverly Hills Cop was your first produced screenplay.
It was.
What led you to that point? How did you prepare for it?
Well, I had wanted to be a writer for many years, but my wife was working, ironically, back at ICM to support us, but I had only one indulgence, which was an office that I could go to for writing. And it was a modest office, a cubicle really, but it was at the corner of Santa Monica and Rodeo Drives in Beverly Hills. So a kid with no money got to see Beverly Hills every day. And I was endlessly amused by that. You'd hear the screech of brakes and you'd look out the window and the Mercedes has hit the rolls and the poodle is escaping. And you'd go down thinking in those days you wore ties to meetings sometimes. And I would go down the street to buy a tie. That looks like a nice tie. $400? No. You know, that led me to think that Beverly Hills was funny. At that point, I didn't know about Michael Eisner insisting that a script be developed about the Beverly Hills Police Department, or that Danilo Bach had written a script, and Vincent Patrick wrote another script, and a third writer wrote yet another script. All of that was new to me. I was writing a picture called Nothing But the Truth, which was later, it was originally called Windy City, but it was eventually filmed as The Big Easy. And that was my audition script. That was the script that got me into the business by selling. And I became, therefore, based on what was a cop movie, but a drama, I became considered the new, meaning cheap, writer for cop movies. And Paramount decided, and this is 2 weeks after the script sold, Paramount decided that they would take me on to do another draft of Beverly Hills Cop. Now, mind you, they would not have hired me to write a comedy. I didn't have the right writing sample to write a comedy. The Big Easy was the sample for a melodrama, for a cop show with some action. So they did not know that I thought Beverly Hills was funny. I presented that notion to them, that I thought it could be funny. But you've heard me talk now for a few minutes, and you can tell it's not a laugh riot. They looked at me like, oh, sure, it could be funny, yeah, but tell me about the gunfights and, you know. Nevertheless, they hired me, and the script was delivered to them, and they got excited about it. They liked the funnier version, and they started on that basis. They greenlit the script on its second draft.
Now, there were several people attached to the movie before Eddie Murphy.
That's right.
So I think Mickey Rourke?
Yes, before I came along.
Was at one point attached to it, and then Sylvester Stallone came on after?
Yes, based on my draft, but he was uncomfortable with the humor and wanted more action. So I did a draft with his notes, mm-hmm. naming him the Motor City Cobra, the Cobretti. The character was Cobretti. And then, as I expected, I was fired so that he could take up the reins of the screenplay himself.
As I understand it, his script was much more of a sort of straightforward revenge action film?
Yes, much more of an action film. And it, most importantly for the story, it ballooned the budget by about a third. So the studio decided that they liked the cheaper, funnier version better.
And then the story goes that about 2 weeks before the film was supposed to start production, he was let go.
It was a month before.
Okay.
And they decided they would either do the script that he originally signed on for, my draft, before adapting it for Stallone, before Motor City Cobra and all of that, or if Stallone's mind had moved on from that script that he originally said yes to be in love with the different version, that Stallone could take everything that I wrote for him and everything that he wrote and make another movie out of it, so long as it wasn't a cop who comes from out of town to Beverly Hills. And the script was his script by then. It was different enough that you could do that. And he decided to do that. He was very gracious about it because instead of insisting on, well, pay me my money, which he could have done, he said, no, give me the scripts and I'll go off and make another movie, which he did. It was Cobra.
Let me come back and backtrack just a little bit to your take on the story, the first one that sort of combined the comedy with the action. So there were a couple of different people who had sort of wrestled with this story before, and you told us a little bit about your experience sort of seeing the absurdity of Beverly Hills. How did you crack open the story in your own mind? What was it that led you to your take on the script?
Well, the take of having it be a guy from Detroit investigating a crime in Beverly Hills struck me as a premise that was also a comedic premise that I thought doing a fish out of water comedy would be the best approach.
Now, what are you doing in Beverly Hills?
I told you, I'm on vacation. I went to the bathroom. The next thing I know, six guys threw me out a window.
Inspector Todd gave me a message for you. Want to hear it?
I don't think so.
He says if you're out here investigating the Tandino murder, you needn't bother coming back. He tells me if we inform him you are working on this case, he'll have you brought up on charges and fired. Now, one last time, what are you doing?
I'm on vacation!
Vacation. Rosewood, take Mr. Foley over to the courthouse and let him arrange for bail.
Follow me, sir.
You know, I gotta hand it to you guys. If anything, you are extremely polite.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival will be back in a moment.
Yeah.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with comedy legend Daniel Petrie Jr.
The previous scripts were more dramatic, more action-oriented. They hadn't done that. The shift from a drama to a comedy is big enough that I didn't change the basic outlines of the story.
Chris Vogler, who has been at this festival before, talks about Beverly Hills Cop in Writer's Journey.
Yeah.
And he has this really interesting take on the story in which he says, you know, Axel is not actually the main character of the story. You know, he thinks of Rosewood and Billy as mm-hmm. the moved characters. When you were looking at your version of the script, I mean, like, what interested you about these characters, and where did you see sort of the movement taking place in terms of those folks?
Wow, that's an interesting point of view. And I can see what he means by they are the characters that change. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're the main characters, because Axel Foley changes his point of view about them and comes to appreciate them as legitimate cops.
Would you mind explaining to me what you and Rosewood were doing in a strip bar out of our jurisdiction when you were still on duty?
Sir, before you chastise these two officers, I think it's something you should know. The only reason that they were at a strip bar is because they were tailing me and I went to this place. Now, these two officers were sitting outside wondering what I was doing. I wasn't having a good time. I'm into things like that. Anyway, these guys waited outside, and the only reason that they came in was because they saw two suspicious-looking gentlemen with bulges in their jackets going into the place. Well, it turns out that these guys were going to commit a robbery, sir. These men watched them, waited for them to make their move, and then they foiled a crime. I did not know what was going on. I was watching the show having fun. I'm still freaked out by it. You must have a sixth sense. I don't know what you teach these fellows, but they're not just regular cops, okay? They're super cops. And the only thing missing on these guys are capes.
And so the stories that I've seen said that you were, I mean, pretty much writing alongside the production.
I was writing up till the day it started. But then, really, Eddie was given his head not to write, but to improvise. He would never do a take quite the same way twice. At the same time, he was extremely gracious to the other actors. He would realize, well, first of all, they're not going to improvise. If their line is 3 o'clock, he's got to come around to say, what time is it, in some fashion, so they can answer 3 o'clock, not, is this the afternoon now? You know, or something that wouldn't produce that answer. So within that, though, you can do quite a bit of improvisation. And he was allowed to, and the movie benefited from it tremendously. Eddie came on board a month before shooting, and he was located in New York. So he came out just before the movie started, and he inhabited the role very quickly. He built it around himself. So there was not a prolonged period of preparation.
Hold it right there, Foley. You're under arrest. Billy, what the hell are you doing here?
I stole my gun and forced him to bring me here.
No, he didn't, Sarge. Look, everything he said about Maitland is right. Now he's kidnapped a woman and he's got her in this house. Well, let's go in there and get her.
The f*** do you think I'm trying to do here?
You're not doing anything. We'll handle this. We'll have a search warrant here in 20 minutes.
She could be dead in 20 minutes.
Stop working on that lock. You're coming with us.
Look, man, I'm going to open up this door and I'm going inside. You want to stop me? Shoot me.
Me too.
Billy.
Really, Sarge, you can do what you want, but I'm going in with Axel. Billy, this is really serious trouble. If you're lucky, you'll just get fired.
Got it.
It's my last warning, Foley. Billy. I'm sorry, Sarge, I've got to.
That relationship between Judge Reinhold and Eddie Murphy, I'm sure was mirrored in some ways on the set. I don't know if they've stayed in touch or if they're great friends, but you certainly saw it, that hero worship on Judge Reinhold's part.
And sort of building off Chris Vogler's comment about the Billy character, that's a character who travels a great distance in the course of the the story.
That's right.
Like, what were you proudest of in terms of his arc? How did you shape that?
Well, I was proud to get that actor to do that part. But I thought that the part was foolproof. A guy who is very naive and kind of slow, but sees what he regards as a real cop from a really challenging police environment, not like Beverly Hills, and sees that other people in his department, his bosses, are wrong in taking Axel lightly.
Rosewood, take Detective Foley back to his hotel room, watch him pack, and escort him to the city limits. When you get there, you can give him his gun back. The two charges of disturbing the peace have been dropped against you. But the chief says if you return to the city of Beverly Hills, the charges will be reinstated, and you will be prosecuted to the limit of the law.
Sir, may I say something?
Billy. What?
Well, he seems to have enough to follow.
You want to tell that to the chief?
No, sir.
Then I suggest you get moving.
Come on, Axel.
They think of him as a nuisance. Judge Reinhold's character thinks of him as a hero.
It's a great arc.
Yeah.
In an article on the film in 1984, you told the New York Times that Eddie would take a line and expand it. He'd put it into the comic persona that he invented for that moment. Could you give us an example or two of maybe a scene that he sort of launched into that wasn't a part of your original script?
Sure. Boy, there are lots. It's hard to pin down one. But checking into the Beverly Hills Hotel or the Beverly Palm Hotel, he launched into a rant about, of course, there's no room available. You know, my version of that was much shorter. And really, the funny part was them saying, oh, we'll give you a suite for the regular room price.
Don't you think I realize what's going on here, miss? Who do you think I am, huh? Don't you think I know that if I was some hotshot from out of town that pulled inside here and you guys made a reservation mistake, I'd be the first one to get a room and I'd be upstairs relaxing right now. But I'm not some hotshot from out of town. I'm a small reporter from Rolling Stone magazine that's in town to do an exclusive interview with Michael Jackson that's going to be picked up by every major magazine in the country. I was going to call the article, Michael Jackson is sitting on top of the world, but now I think I might as well just call it, Michael Jackson can sit on top of the world just as long as he doesn't sit in the Beverly Palm Hotel because there's no allowed in there.
Excuse me, sir. It seems that we do have a last-minute cancellation. There is a room available. It's a suite, but I'll only charge you the single room rate.
Thank you. I'm sorry I got upset. It's probably from jet lag or something. I'm very tired.
I understand,
What's
sir.
The rate, anyway?
That'll be $235 a night, sir.
It was something that was really big money in those days.
So I think Martin Brest talked about the scene where he shows up at Victor Maitland's club and sort of creates the character of the gay man who wants to talk to his lover about herpes simplex 10.
Yes. In the script that I wrote, it was just him saying, I have news for him about, but not the character, not that he would assume the character of, no, it's me that has this disease and I need to tell him that he's been exposed. But that was great, and Eddie just flipped into that.
May I help you?
Yes. I'm looking for Victor Maitland.
You realize that this is a members-only club?
Mm-hmm, but I have to talk to Victor. It's very, very important.
Are you sure it's Victor Maitland you want?
Oh, yes, Victor Maitland, the gray-haired gentleman, very dark-skinned, Capricorn, Victor.
Well, why don't you give me the message, and I'll take it to him.
Okay, I guess I can do that. Tell Victor that Ramon, the fella he met about a week ago, tell him that Ramon went to the clinic today and I found out that I have herpes simplex 10. And I think Victor should go check himself out with his physician to make sure everything is fine before things start falling off on the man.
Perhaps you better tell him that.
The earlier scripts on this were pretty much straight action. And your concept on this was, let's bring in the idea of doing a fish-out-of-water comedy. And one of the few sort of negative reviews that I found about the film is Roger Ebert's, which I'm sure was unpleasant at the time. But his big thing was, is this an action film or is it a comedy film? And, of course, it's both. But when you're writing in multiple genres, you've got to set up set pieces in both genres. So how did you approach that? How did you say, I'm going to make a cop film that's also a comedy film and serve both of those genres in a way that audiences will feel like they got their money's worth?
I had a rule, and that was the bad guys can't be funny. Very often you'll see cop comedy films where everything is kind of trying for comedy, but you really can't do that. You have to, if people get shot, they get killed or seriously wounded. If you're chasing, you're really chasing. All of those things that cops do that aren't in a funny environment, they can't be funny. At the same time, they can have funny observations about what world they're living in, what the bad guys are doing, what is going on around them. So that was kind of my guiding principle.
Well, cuz.
Are you still pissed at me?
Oh, no. No. But I should have taken care of you in Detroit. When I popped your little buddy.
Goodbye, Mr. Foley. Have a nice day.
I'll try.
And I remember an interview where you talked about some interviews with cops who had this sort of strange tonal mix between, you know, danger and comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about what you learned from their dialogue and the way that they sort of treated their work?
Cops tend to be very funny people. I think it's because of the high-pressure environment that they work in, but they generate their own comic relief. They're confronted with death and serious crime, and they can't survive if they take on the burden of that all the time. So they have to treat it with humor. That was an important insight for me.
So this was the highest grossing film of 1984. And there were like some substantial films from that year. Just sort of looking at my list, Ghostbusters, The Terminator, and then some really critically acclaimed films, The Natural, Amadeus, Places in the Heart. As a nonfiction writer, one of the things that I'm really interested in is cultural criticism, which is kind of asking the question of why is a particular story important at a particular moment? And so one of the things I wonder if you've reflected on is why was this movie so popular in 1984? What was it about the story that you and Eddie and Martin were telling that appealed to so many people? What is the longevity here? Why is this still a current story?
Well, I think the triumph of a down-to-earth character against pretension was a big part of it. But if you're talking about the film's success, Eddie was a big part of it. There was so much anticipation for a new film from him. It had been considered by the industry that he had to be teamed up with a white star to be in a movie, and this, because of its crazy origin, wasn't that way. It was a soul-starring vehicle for Eddie, and there was a great anticipation for it. The movie opened as a very successful film. Mm-hmm. That meant that the audience was eager to see it. One thing is it's a cop show, but it's not a mystery. We know that it's Victor Maitland is the bad guy from the moment that Eddie sets eyes on him, and we're not wrong. So there's no element of surprise that once it's revealed, it takes away the enjoyment of the movie for the audience. Rather, the story is about how does this underdog take on a rich, powerful, connected person in a city where the rich, powerful, and connected are protected by the cops? How does he triumph over that? And that's a story that people can revisit over and over.
So here is somebody who is taking some of the stuff that you've written and transforming it in some way. So I think originally the banana in the tailpipe was a potato in the tailpipe?
In the old days, before the ignition systems that you have now, you could jam a baking potato, a raw baking potato, into a tailpipe, and it would block the exhaust, and therefore the car would stall right away. As far as I know, a banana in the tailpipe wouldn't do that. So the script had a potato in the tailpipe, but they're shooting in the Grand Hotel, but they're set up to shoot in the lobby and with the restaurant area or the, you know. In the script, it said he goes out through the kitchen and he takes a raw potato. But they couldn't do that. They couldn't have access to the kitchen. They're working in the kitchen. So they decided that it would have to be a banana. The banana is funnier, and no one cared that you could that you could not actually block the exhaust of a car with a banana, although they tried to show that with, he inserts like three bananas. But I was worried that the audience would say, oh no, that wouldn't work. But everybody in the audience was very gracious to us.
A banana in your tailpipe? How could you not notice a man sticking a banana in your tailpipe?
Well, he distracted us, sir.
And how'd he do that?
Well, he sent us a late supper, sir. See, this waiter comes over.
Billy, he gets the point.
And so maybe reflecting on not just the stuff that you wrote, but the things that Eddie improvised, what could we sort of carry away from those things?
Well, I think being true to your genre and what you decide the action comedy genre should be. Some people would define it more broadly as a broader comedy and think, well, that character has to be funny in a different way, a figure of fun. But no, Eddie was doing bits, but he was doing them with an intention. With his cop intention, he was talking his way into this place, or he would be in the drug warehouse and say, you offered me a match. You know, he was doing all of his bits with an intention, playing drunk. Hey, Phil, how are you, Phil? To foil a robbery at the bar. I would say that, kind of figure out what the genre you're going for, and writing true to that, even if your character is got to do something different.
Was there anything that you learned from watching Eddie at work about comedy or how to write comedy?
Oh, just hope that you have Eddie Murphy and people will think you're a genius.
And you'll get nominated for the Academy Award.
That's right. That's right.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Sciences, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Story is supported in part by DePaul University's School of Cinematic Arts. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Maya Perez, and Katie Turner. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from Travis Kennedy and the Sound Lab, Inc. in Austin, Texas. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.